Blood sugar levels that are higher than normal, though not quite high enough to be diabetes, is called pre-diabetes. With no signs or symptoms, it doesn't sound too risky, right? Wrong. All the while, long-term damage to heart, blood vessels and kidneys may actually be happening. And associated insulin resistance brings high blood pressure, high blood fats and high cholesterol. So can we undo that process? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Meet Robbie, who had a serious childhood illness. Watch.
When I was 12 years old, I was getting thirsty all the time and drinking all day long and complaining to my mom, "I think I have diabetes just like Steve." So I am the youngest of three boys, and my middle brother had type 1 diabetes before I was diagnosed. So I was aware of the symptoms. And my mom said, no, don't be silly. You don't have diabetes. So I just kept on going through life and drinking a lot, going to the bathroom a lot. And eventually, my parents were out of town in Florida looking at homes because we were going to move there. And I was home in Minnesota with my brother, who also has type 1 diabetes. And my mom called to check in. And I said, "Mom, I couldn't sleep last night. I was cramping." She said, "Okay, go upstairs, use your brother's blood glucose meter and test yourself." So I did, and I was over 400, which is four times higher than I'm supposed to be. And my brother said right then and there, "You have type 1 diabetes, pack your bags, you're going to be in the hospital for a few days." So we went to the regular doctor first, and he drew a blood test, and I'm not sure what test they did run, but they said, "Yes, you have type 1 diabetes." And I remember sitting in that room, seeing my older brother cry for the first time, and he was just saying, "Hey, I'm sorry you have to go through this, you know." And then my parents flew home right away from Florida, and that night in the hospital, I remember my dad saying, "Don't worry, it's just an inconvenience. You can do whatever you want in life, and it's not going to be a problem." So I only stayed one night since my parents knew what to do, and we went home, and I started living with type 1 diabetes. So originally, my parents wanted us to have the best health care possible. So living in Minnesota, we drove to Rochester to see a doctor at the Mayo Clinic. And looking back, it's kind of disappointing to see how that high level of care didn't include a really good nutrition program. I did have a nutritionist, but they weren't teaching anything about plant-based nutrition or any of that, or anything about reversing insulin resistance or anything like that. It was really just eat whatever you want, but count the carbohydrates so you know how much insulin to inject. And there was a huge focus on helping people not feel weird. I mean, "Oh, you've been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, you're young, we want you to still feel like you're just like your friends and you can eat whatever you want." And looking back, I see that as a mistake, because this is actually a great opportunity for anybody to transform their life. Being the type of person I am, that led me to do research and learn, okay, what can I do actually more than just following the standard American diet? Initially, my dad was selling supplements. He was part of a network marketing company called Herbalife. And that got me started in this process. Okay, wait a minute. There's more to nutrition than just eating the standard American diet. And that was the beginning of me starting to learn more and more and just read books. And every step of the way, it was just a logical progression. So every step of the way, I was learning something new that made sense. Like, okay, yeah, I can go with that.
On today's show, we have more from Robbie on nutrition and diabetes. Our expert guest is on the Exercises Medicine Steering Committee for the American College of Sports Medicine. Sean will dish out some of that medicine, and we'll take an in-depth look at meal timing for both weight and diabetes. But first things first, here's the news. In the headlines, pollution promotes diabetes, sugar makes men sad, and mouthwash diabetes link. Living near a busy road, drinking out of plastic water bottles and eating out of cans or plastics may predispose to diabetes because of endocrine-disrupting chemicals in pollution and plastics. One study has shown that living less than 100 yards from a busy road was associated with a 37% increased risk of developing diabetes compared with living over 200 yards away. In Germany, long-term exposure to air traffic pollutants was associated with greater insulin resistance in 10-year-old children. Chemicals that can increase the risk of diabetes include PCBs, organochlorine pesticides, multiple chemical constituents of air pollution, BPA and phthalates. So limit your exposure to plastics and pollutants as much as possible. A high intake of sugar appears to put men at risk of mood disorders. The University College of London enrolled more than 10,000 middle-aged government workers in a health and behaviour study and followed them for 30 years. They found that men with the highest intake of sugary foods and drinks were 23% more likely to have recurrent depression, anxiety, and insomnia. The same association was not apparent for women, though women under 50 were far more likely to have depression at the start of the study compared with men. Though we should all aim to limit our intake of added sugars for so many great reasons. The frequent use of mouthwash appears to increase the risk for pre-diabetes and diabetes. More than 1,200 overweight and obese adults aged 40 to 65 years with no diabetes or major cardiovascular disease were followed for 3 years. Researchers found that those who were obese and used mouthwash at least twice a day had a 65% higher risk of pre-diabetes and diabetes than those who used mouthwash less frequently. It's thought that mouthwash may eradicate bacteria in the mouth that are necessary for the formation of nitric oxide. That's likely to predispose to metabolic dysfunction, including diabetes. So if you like to rinse with mouthwash, limit it to only once a day. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Dr. Elizabeth Joy, sports medicine physician at Salt Lake Clinic Live Well Center in Utah. We met her in Indianapolis at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine meeting there, where she was talking about pre-diabetes. I asked her how many Americans are affected by diabetes and pre-diabetes.
Well, recent figures would say that 30 million Americans have diabetes, 95% of which is type 2 diabetes. That leaves about 84 million Americans, or almost one in three, who have prediabetes, which is, you know, not quite yet diabetes. We estimate that about 25% of those with prediabetes will develop type 2 diabetes in 3 to 5 years, and about 50% in 8 to 10 years. So not everybody with prediabetes gets type 2, you know, but a significant majority.
And I guess if you wait long enough, if you keep tracking for 15 years, you'll see.
Yes, you would see an increasing, you know, cumulative incidence of type 2 diabetes over time. And, you know, it is the most expensive healthcare condition in the United States.
Is that right?
Absolutely. Wow. You know, we spend over $100 billion a year, you know, on diabetes care.
Wow. And so that tsunami of the extra 85 that million that
yes.
will convert to diabetes is just going to blow the budget, really.
Absolutely. I mean, when you really think about, you know, what are the conditions that are undermining, you know, healthcare in the United States, and diabetes is definitely the biggest actor in that. And of course, about 2/3 of people who have coronary artery disease and suffer a heart attack have type 2 diabetes or have diabetes. And so, you know, by preventing diabetes, we not only are, you know, we're preventing heart disease, we're preventing chronic kidney disease, we're preventing stroke. You know, it really is, you know, kind of a gateway disease, you know, to things that, you know, end up killing people.
So we're talking now real quality of life. So how do we drive back? How do we keep that pre-diabetes or that diabetes at bay, push that pre-diabetes back? What's the most effective intervention?
Sure. Well, the foundation of all of this is lifestyle behaviors. You know, and when we talk about diabetes prevention programs, they are founded, you know, on people changing their diet, increasing their physical activity, with a goal being to lose a 5 to 7% weight loss from their baseline.
So 5 to 7% is not a huge amount. Most people will set a bigger goal than that, won't they?
I think people, you know, oftentimes are influenced by shows like The Biggest Loser, right, where successful weight loss is defined by 100-pound weight loss. But it turns out that to improve your health, whether we're talking about preventing diabetes, reducing sleep apnea, which of course is a growing problem, decreasing the stress on knees and hips and all the joint replacements that happen as a result of that, you know, somewhere between a 5 and a 10% weight loss from baseline, you know, can make a significant, clinically meaningful quality of life difference. You know, it doesn't take 100 pounds.
Which is good news, because that's a reachable goal for most of us. More from Dr. Joy in the next segment, so stand by. But before the break, watch this.
What would you like to drink, sir?
Coke, please.
And for you, ma'am?
Nothing, thank you.
Water, then?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes, thank you, though.
What? No water? How do you swallow your food, then, without washing it down?
But if you wash it down, it slows digestion. Because it dilutes the digestive juices.
Well, that might be good for me with my heartburn.
Actually, it might be worse, too.
What do you mean?
Well, if you drink with this meal, it slows digestion. Then when you go to bed, your stomach won't be empty. You lie down, and that food and acid can come up and into the back of your throat.
Ooh, the back of my throat, like one of those birds that feeds its young, pre-digested food?
Well, kind of, yes.
Ooh, yuck.
Yeah, yuck. So why don't you try eating without drinking?
But what do you do with really dry food like bread? You just take tons of butter and put it on it?
No, all that fat will slow digestion also. See, if you're eating lots of fruit and vegetables, they contain plenty of water, and it's naturally mineralized and distilled, even better than drinking water with your meals.
But then I'll miss out on my ice.
Well, that's true, and ice slows digestion even further.
Oh, no, you're kidding me.
No. You see, the stomach needs to warm it up before it can begin digestion.
Oh, well, I'll burp to that one then.
Oh, brother, I can't take you anywhere. Don't drink with your meals. Doctor's orders.
The traditional meal pattern is to eat 3 meals a day. But then came along the snack. Highly processed food in crinkly bags that messes with our metabolism and has us addicted. So we found ourselves still eating the 3 meals, with a mid-morning snack, mid-afternoon snack, and a bedtime snack. But we didn't really change the size of our meals, and so our meals changed the size of us. In order to lose weight, the 6-meal-a-day plan was born. Why do we need to eat so often? Well, so we don't experience hunger. But does it really work? Actually, science tells us it drives hunger and food cravings, increases belly fat, lays fat down in the liver, increases diabetes, and makes us gain weight. So what is the ideal meal pattern for weight loss and for health? The Adventist Health Study came to the rescue. They studied meal frequency and timing amongst 50,000 Adventists for 7 years to see if their weight was going up or going down, where it was going. They found those that were eating 1 or 2 meals a day, these 1 or 2, weighed a little less every year than those who were eating all 3 meals. Those eating more than 3 times a day, in other words, the snackers, weighed a little more each year than the 3-meal-a-day group. So the more frequency, the greater the weight. So for weight loss, that suggests 1 to 2 meals a day is better than 3, definitely better than being a snacker. So how far apart should those 2 meals be? What they found was interesting. Those who had a break of 18 hours or more from the end of one day to the start of the next day weighed a little less each year than those who had a 12 to 17 hour break. And that's because for the first 12 hours, our body burns sugar. After that, it begins to burn fat. Now, you might expect that you're going to get really hungry having an overnight fast of 18 hours. But other research has shown that there's less hunger when we limit our eating to 6 hours in the day. So if we go for 2 meals a day, should we skip the breakfast and just do lunch and dinner, which a lot of people do, or should we keep the breakfast? Well, the breakfast eaters experienced a decreased weight compared to breakfast skippers. So we need to keep the breakfast right here. But which should be our largest meal? Should it be in the evening when we're relaxing after a hard day at the office, or the breakfast? You guessed it, a big breakfast had the biggest decrease in weight, and a big lunch gave a smaller decrease than having a big dinner. So, if you want to make it easier to control your weight, eat less frequency. Just two meals is better than three. Avoid the snacks. Make sure you eat breakfast and make it the biggest meal of the day. Then leave 5 or 6 hours between breakfast and lunch, and then don't eat for 18 to 19 hours. That might sound too difficult to you, and you're just going to throw this idea out the door. I challenge you, though, to try it for a week. Here's what you do. Start with dropping the snacks. Let's just put all the snacks aside, okay? And then we're going to put breakfast in. Let's say you don't normally eat breakfast. Well, now you want to add a whole grain breakfast like this. Oatmeal, perhaps throw in some nuts, some fruit, fresh fruit, dried fruit if you prefer, and just stick to three meals. But what you're going to do is you're going to move your calories earlier in the day, right? So now lunch will be your bigger meal, and supper will get smaller and smaller and smaller until you can eliminate it. And then you're down to two meals. It's that simple. And your hunger and your food cravings will subside. Just try it. Remember Robbie? He's the youngest of three boys, and his older brother was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So when Robbie noticed the same symptoms, he guessed he had it too. After learning how to give himself insulin and count carbs, he wanted more. So he embarked on a hunt for the best nutrition for diabetes. His goal? To get his pancreatic beta cells to work again. Watch.
What happened is I started following a lot of different diets. Initially, I had followed the Weston A. Price Foundation diet. I was eating grass-fed beef, lots of raw milk, and this all made sense initially. You know, grass-fed beef is better than the processed beef. You know, there was logic behind maybe it's not good to pasteurize our milk. It all just made sense. But I never really got the results I was looking for in regards to seeing improvements in insulin sensitivity. So eventually, I then followed a vegan ketogenic diet where I was eating nothing but oil and greens and nuts and seeds. And eventually, I got terribly low energy. I could not sustain that diet any longer. Even though, as a person living with type 1 diabetes, I saw that not eating any carbohydrates led to a reduction in the total amount of insulin I needed. So at the time, I thought this was great. Wow, I'm taking less and less insulin. But that wasn't, in hindsight, that didn't mean anything unless my pancreas was beginning to produce more of its own insulin. So what I was doing is I was doing a little bit of a hack, which is why there's so much confusion in the world of diabetes nutrition. People who do a ketogenic diet, especially the people living with type 1, they can take a very, very low amount of insulin, but it doesn't mean they're healthier. They're actually more insulin resistant. And that's what I learned. So at that time, I was eating roughly 30 grams of carbohydrate per day, taking 10 units of total insulin. So that's a 3-to-1 ratio. And now, as I've transitioned to a low-fat, plant-based, whole food lifestyle, I'm eating more than 700 grams of carbohydrate per day and taking roughly 38 units of insulin. So that's more insulin, but the insulin sensitivity has dramatically improved. So my body's ability to take glucose out of my bloodstream into the cells has improved. It's very important for overall health. The number one thing that people die of, no matter what form of diabetes they're living with, is heart disease. So just focusing on controlling numbers isn't really going to solve the problem, or one of the biggest problems for type 1 diabetes.
Or for any type of diabetes, for that matter. However, there's something that will help to solve the big problem of heart disease. I asked Dr. Joy to share the details of a study that showed how effective physical activity can be in that arena.
So the National Diabetes Prevention Study, which was published decades ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, they randomized about 3,000 people, 1,000 into each group, who had glucose intolerance. So I don't think they really called it prediabetes at that time, but they had glucose intolerance. And one group was randomized to, you know, what we now refer to as the National Diabetes Prevention Program. It was a lifestyle program, you know, with a low-fat diet, low-fat, low-calorie diet. They were encouraged to achieve 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity. They met regularly with a coach, both one-on-one and in group learning sessions. Another group was randomized to metformin, and a third group was randomized to a placebo. And neither the metformin group or the placebo group got the rest of the intervention. And they followed those cohorts over time, actually for about 10 years all in all. But what was really interesting was that about 2 years into the intervention, when they were looking at the cumulative incidence of type 2 diabetes, they found that compared to the placebo group, there was a 58% decrease in the cumulative incidence of type 2 diabetes in the intervention group. And I think it was only about 34% cumulative decrease in incidence amongst the metformin group. So we have lifestyle outperforming the pill.
Almost double.
Almost double. And amongst older adults, so those that were 60 years of age and older, there was a 71% decrease in the cumulative incidence of type 2 diabetes. So I guess that that goes against the adage of you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And of course, we think that the older adults were, you know, maybe they had less, you know, work responsibilities. And so they were able to participate in all aspects of the lifestyle change program that the diabetes prevention program was offering.
True. But it also just reminds you that it's never too late.
You're absolutely.
You're never too old to make those changes. And like you say, to learn new tricks. How did they compare cost-wise, the lifestyle intervention versus the metformin? What was more cost-effective?
Well, I think in the long run, you know, it's going to be the lifestyle group, right? Because if you can delay or prevent the onset of type 2 diabetes, you have considerable savings. In our own healthcare system, I work at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City, Utah. We've estimated that, you know, the year that someone converts from pre-diabetes to type 2 diabetes, the cost differential in that just 1 year is about $3,500.
Wow.
You know, so that's pretty big. I mean, it certainly doesn't cost us $3,500 per person to participate in the diabetes prevention program. It's considerably less than that. So, you know, imagine putting, you know, tens, now hundreds of thousands of people, of course, through the diabetes prevention program. And, you know, there's really considerable cost savings.
Now, a key piece of that, it's not just diet, it's exercise, isn't it?
Yes, yep.
And tell us what, we've got exercise guidelines. Tell us what they are and how they are actually derived.
So the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans were published in 2008. They're currently being updated right now. The evidence review has come out. We can anticipate the guidelines being published in 2019. They're actually, you know, were our very first physical activity guidelines ever. We've had dietary guidelines in the United States since the 1800s. But we didn't get our first physical activity guidelines until 2008.
You probably didn't need them in the 1800s.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we've so successfully engineered physical activity out of our lifestyles that, yeah, now we have to engineer it back in. You know, like things like walking treadmill desks and things like that to get people to move more.
That's right.
But, you know, the guidelines for Americans say that people should get a minimum of 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity or 75 minutes a week of vigorous activity, which would be like jogging, really, you know, moderate being a brisk walk, vigorous being something akin to jogging that gets you out of breath. Exactly. And also strength training, doing, you know, muscle strengthening at least 2 times per week of your major muscle groups. And that's the recommendations for adults, you know, younger adults and older adults. It really doesn't change. And for children, we recommend even more activity, more like 60 minutes a day. So in a combination of aerobic activity and muscle activity and bone loading and things like that.
So they get almost 3 times as much.
Right. You know, kids have to do more, right?
Yes.
They're very plastic, right? We're trying to get them to really, you know, develop all those motor skills, you know, in addition to, of course, all the other benefits that you derive from regular exercise.
Right. And they've got brain development
Absolutely.
Going on, haven't they?
Yep.
Yeah. So those are the guidelines, but why the 150? What are the benefits to following the guidelines? What are you going to get for that?
Well, you know, if you look at, you know, survival curves, and you can see that, you know, there's a significant break in the curve, you know, at about 150 minutes per week, you know, in terms of, you know, your likelihood of premature mortality.
So you're going to live longer.
You're going to live longer. And in fact, there was a recent study published just last week in JAMA Internal Medicine, you know, that it looked retrospectively, you know, at over 100,000 people who had undergone treadmill testing. And so they were able to actually measure their cardiorespiratory fitness. And they also had self-reported physical activity levels for those people, which is, of course, you know, the number one predictor of one's cardiorespiratory fitness. And they found that those at the highest fitness level lived the longest. I mean, it's really no surprise. And in fact, fitness was a more important and larger predictor of premature mortality compared to high blood pressure or smoking. So when we say sitting is the new smoking, you know, there's probably some truth to that. You know, sitting is not something that people should do long term. We should really try and avoid it. Maybe you and I should stand up right now for the rest of our interview.
I suggested intermittent fasting earlier in the show, but here's another aspect to consider. The Bible says that Jesus' ministry began with a supernatural 40-day fast. By it, he developed intimacy with God. He learned dependence on God, and he gained the mastery over appetite. He had just been baptized or anointed for mission. His ministry would be the hardest 3.5 years of his entire life. He would need to have a vital connection with heaven. It could not be tenuous, it could not be spasmodic. He would have to spend whole nights in prayer. Later, when his disciples failed to cast a demon out of a child, Jesus told them, "If you have faith, nothing will be impossible to you. But this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." If there is a stronghold in your life that you're struggling to overcome, that seems impossible to surmount despite your best efforts, perhaps you might want to try prayer and fasting. It can be the fastest way to gain victory over Satan. It's been said that if exercise could be packed into a pill, it would be the single most widely prescribed and beneficial medicine in the nation. So, Sean, how are you packaging our exercise pill today?
Well, we're packaging it into like a big core pill, all right?
Ooh.
Yes.
Ooh.
Now, you know core exercises is the focal point for all that we do. Functional exercise is how we lift things up, how we put it over our head. It all makes a difference in our daily activities. Now, many people are tweaking their back because when they pick something up, they're not keeping their core tight. So this is a reminder for you. As you move throughout the day and all that we do, keep these exercises in the back of your mind. How can you improve on these, but in turn, improve on your daily activities, right?
Yeah.
So let's work these core exercises. We're gonna do an alternating reach out, alternating lateral lunge, okay? I want you to go as deep as you can, and I want you to hold right here. But in this position, reach forward. Bringing that belly button to the spine. 3, 2, 1, get to the other side. What this is doing is allowing you to feel how when you hold a position here, extend your arm, you can engage that core. When you start to realize how much the core is involved in all that we do, you start to do your exercise with a more of a purpose in mind, okay?
Right.
So get to the other side and we'll get started. 3, 2, keep it tight, and 1, nice. We're gonna start with our plank, okay? The plank is one of the most widely known exercises out there, but I'm gonna show you a new version today, right?
All right.
On the elbows. Now, core nice and tight. I'm gonna challenge you to do something. If you have a mat, I want you to take your elbows and imagine yourself pulling your elbows towards your sneaker, right? As if you're dragging it, right? What this is doing is it intentionally engages your core. Many times we do the plank and we could hold it for 5, 6, 7 minutes. But if I tell you to engage it, pull, right? 3, 2, you can rest.
Okay.
What happens is that we can lose sight of what the true purpose of the core of the plank is.
Right.
All right. So dragging your elbow with a mat, right, allows you to really engage everything. In the event that you have any elbow issues, you can always go with a high plank. Start here. Make sure that your eyes are facing down, never up, because you put the strain on your neck.
Right.
All right. Hold it nice and strong. And then you can do the same thing, kind of just pulling in, bringing your feet towards your hand. All right. Exercise number two. All right. You have your knee ins. All right. Where you're coming up here, and I just want you to grab your knees or right around your shin. This is a great exercise because once your knees come in, you have to engage your core, all right? Just by bringing your knees in and exhaling, it's a core exercise, all right? Come up. Now you can make this more intense by being very explosive, or you can go nice and slow, squeezing it. Squeeze a little bit more, bring it all the way in, contract all of your abdominal muscles, keep it nice and tight, and extend all the way out. The art of bringing your foot all the way out and bring it back in, you're using all of the abdominis of erectus right here.
Okay? Yeah, lie down.
Yep.
Yep.
And number three, remember, we're gonna have some fun.
Okay.
We're gonna use a 5-pound dumbbell. And this is a twist, all right, where we're just going to the left, come back to the center, and to the right, allowing us to engage our core nice and controlled without putting any strain on our lower back. Now, in order for you to challenge yourself a little bit, you can put that right leg up a little bit.
It's good, thank you.
There you go. It's a small thing, but
makes
now
a big difference.
You're now challenging your body to kind of reorient itself and challenging your core to stabilize. It's a small change, but it challenges you in a different way.
Right.
So those three exercises, do them for about 30 seconds each. Take a rest, do about 4 to 5 rounds. That will torch your whole midsection.
It did.
All right?
Yeah.
So now you're here, lean back a little bit, stretch your abdominal area. This is stretching everything in here that you just engaged. Rotate, be cautious with the rotation, see how far you can go. Go within the limit of your body. Roll your shoulders back, roll them forward. Sometimes we get tense with our core exercises. Are you feeling your neck?
Yeah.
So big circle. Switch direction. Come back and you are all done.
Woo, thanks, Sean.
You're very welcome.
Good work.
What is the best method of controlling adult onset diabetes? A 2002 study by the U.S. Diabetes Prevention Program enrolled 3,000 individuals to find out. They tested the advantages of either a popular diabetes drug or an active exercise program of 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. The results showed that the exercise was more effective than the medication. And the results were greatest for the oldest individuals. 30 minutes of exercise a day is another ageless advantage.
It's always good to get your questions, but I get way too many to bring them all onto the show, so I apologize for that. I'll just pick out the ones that are more popular or the ones that are more generic. So here's someone texted in. They said, is it good to clean your tongue by brushing or scraping it? And why do dental crowns cause bad breath? Well, if you like to scrape your tongue, go right ahead, but it's not necessary to brush or scrape our tongues in order to keep them clean. Have a look at your tongue, and if it's coated, sort of white and coated, that may indicate a buildup of debris, bacteria, perhaps dead cells. And a coated tongue is more likely if you smoke, if you breathe through your mouth, especially at night, say if you're a snorer, if you have a yeast infection, or if you're using certain medications, or even if you just don't take good care of your mouth in general, you don't brush your teeth often enough. Now, in that instance, scraping can help bad breath, but just for a few hours. It's not going to last very long. When it comes to dental crowns, they should not cause bad breath, and if they do, it probably indicates a poor fit and that bacteria are crowding in into the gaps around that crown. So do your basics, brush your teeth, and if you want to, you scrape your tongue or brush your tongue twice a day. Rinse with water right after meals, floss every day, drink plenty of water, and have your dentist assess the reason for your bad breath. Someone called and asked, is beet sugar healthy? Well, any added sugar is not healthy. We need to limit consumption of our sugar. But that may leave you wondering why you are seeing beet sugar, bags of beet sugar in your health store, right? I'll bet that's where this question came from. Well, table sugar is made of beet sugar or sugarcane crystals.
sugarcane is brown, but to make it white, they kind of put it through a process with charcoal that's made from animal bones. Beet sugar is naturally white, doesn't require that process. So now health stores are getting onto this and they carry beet sugar, just pure beet sugar, so that vegans or vegetarians can avoid the use of animal products and the processing of their white sugar. So just remember that 95% of sugar in that we get here in America, the beet crops are genetically engineered to be Roundup ready. And that means that they're going to have more pesticide, more Roundup in them. Now, you probably feel like you're between a rock and a hard place now. So try replacing sugar with dates, bananas, or erythritol. Arthur asks, I've been suffering with tinnitus for a year now. What should I do? Well, tinnitus is that sensation of noise or ringing in the ears. It is surprisingly common. About 1 in 5 people are affected. And it can be anything from a low roar to buzzing or hissing, even to a loud squeal, high-pitched squeal in one or both ears. Now, it isn't serious, but it certainly can get annoying. It can result from just aging. It's just age-related hearing loss, and you can get this happening. Maybe you went to a concert recently and you've still got the buzzing in your ears. That will pass. It can happen from just earwax building up inside, and so you sort of have this roar inside your ears, or stiffening of the ear bones in the middle ear, otosclerosis it's called, and that runs in families. And then there are things like Meniere's disease, temporomandibular joint dysfunction, which your dentist should have a look at, head and neck injuries, or even a benign tumor on the nerve that supplies your inner ear. So if it is bothering you, see your doctor and have it checked out. Now remember, you can send your question in by Facebook, text, go to our website, and my team or I will do our best to answer your questions. You can do it on Facebook. Join our community on Facebook and see our videos and our sharing there. Now, let's see what we could serve for dinner tonight. Oranges are, well, orange inside and out. There are many varieties, bitter or sweet, thick skin or thin, easy to peel or not. They originated in Asia, around China and Indonesia, and then they went from there to India and then on to the rest of the world. Mostly now they're grown in Brazil and Florida. Oranges are a great source of potassium, magnesium, vitamin C, fiber, calcium, and folate, which are all important for pregnancy. One medium orange is about 60 calories, and it's hard to overindulge in them because they're so full of fiber. Orange zest is a secret ingredient in many recipes. And just below the zest is the pith. It's bitter, but it's loaded with powerful bioflavonoids that are recommended for fighting colds and flus, so don't be afraid to eat it. However, there's nothing like a small glass of freshly squeezed orange juice to wake those taste buds up in the morning. Bon appetit! It's recommended that we all get 150 minutes of moderate intensity or 75 minutes of vigorous intensity physical activity plus 2 20-minute sessions of muscle strengthening every week. Today's guest, Dr. Liz Joy, chairs the Exercise as Medicine Clinical Practice Committee for the American College of Sports Medicine. I asked her how many of us meet the guidelines.
Let's go back to even the measurement, the idea of measurement, right? So a lot of the measurement of physical activity or the surveillance of physical activity is done through self-reported questionnaires, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, which we refer to as BRFSS. And it surveys, you know, people across the United States regarding their physical activity levels and through a number of questions. And when you look at BRFSS data, it looks at about maybe 50% of people are meeting recommended levels of physical activity. However, you know, when they do the NHANES study, which is the National Health and Nutrition Examination study, where they actually objectively measure physical activity, that number drops considerably. And, you know, let's face it, the truth lies somewhere in between. Because when you put a device on someone, let's say you're using your iPhone to track your steps, or in NHANES they put an accelerometer on you to actually measure your activity, it might not pick up what you did in your yoga class. It won't pick up, you know, the 30 minutes you spent on the elliptical trainer or the 2 miles that you swam in the pool, right? So, you know, it's an imperfect science, you know, in terms of measuring the amount of physical activity people get. So, you know, again, the truth lies somewhere in between, you know, in terms of aerobic activity. When we start to include strength training, you know, are people actually doing strength training of major muscle groups at least twice a week? Gosh, the number drops precipitously.
Really?
Even lower. And there's so many reasons for that, right? I mean, somebody can go to one of the commercial fitness facilities, you know, and maybe they'll work with a personal trainer. But oftentimes people get those memberships that $15 to $30 comes out of their bank account every single month. And they look at this room full of equipment and they're just intimidated, right?
Right.
They don't know what to do.
No.
I mean, you know, you and I, we went to medical school. We certainly didn't learn how to lift weights there or teach our patients how to do it.
No, that's right. Right.
I mean, I was a Division I athlete and learned how to, you know, do weight training there. But, boy, that's a minority. We don't teach weight training to our high school kids for the most part. So where do they learn, right? Mm. They have low self-efficacy around strength training, so they just don't do it.
Right.
So it's really no surprise to me that we have a problem when it comes to that. And, of course, it's so important for aging.
Yes.
Right?
Tell us, tease that out for us a bit.
So, you know, healthy aging or aging in place, aging at home, you know, is really dependent on us being able to be functional in our homes. You know, and the function is simple as getting out of a chair, you know, just rising out of a chair. It takes power, you know, muscle strength applied over a very quick amount of time. That's power. And of course, power. We've got to think back to our medical school days again, our little muscle exercise physiology. You know, that's our type 2 fibers. Type 1 being our endurance fibers, type 2 fibers being our fast twitch fibers. And it turns out with aging, you tend to preferentially lose your type 2 fibers, right? Mm. So when we talk about age-related sarcopenia or that loss of muscle mass with aging, you are preferentially losing those fast twitch fibers. And I know, you know, yes, you need fast twitch fibers to run a 100-yard dash, but even more importantly, you need fast twitch muscles to get out of a chair.
So that power comes from your fast twitch.
That's
right. How do we maintain that and prevent that loss with aging?
Right. Well, you know, and that's really been, you know, some of the work, you know, in the last decade looking at strength training in older adults, you know, and the importance of actually doing that. So that they can do what's called functional training, you know, where they're actually training for activities of daily living. They're not training to throw a football farther, you know, or jump higher. They are training to be able to get out of a chair. They're training to be able to get themselves off the floor if they trip and fall, which, of course, we all do throughout our life, starting from the, you know, 9 months of age until 90 years of age. You know, we're always falling. But, of course, if you ask people, they all want to get up, and they all want to get up on their own. Even the nine-month-old wants to get up on their own.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
that's true.
So it's very important to do that.
So with type 2, we started by talking about type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes.
Yes.
And we've talked about the cardiovascular fitness, the strength training.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best form of exercise for diabetes or for prevention?
I think the best form of exercise is actually the type that somebody wants to do, you know, and walking is pretty accessible to most people. I won't say to all because it's definitely not accessible to all, but, you know, a brisk walk where you're, you know, walking fast enough to carry on a conversation, but you're not so out of breath that you can't talk to the person you're with is sufficient, you know, to meet the aerobic exercise recommendations of the diabetes prevention program. But let's say somebody...
And that's 150 minutes
150
of that
minutes.
So it's only 22 minutes a day.
Right. Or 30 minutes, 5 days awake, take a couple days off, you know?
Right.
Go take your dog for a walk. You know, walk with a friend. So walking is great. You know, for some people, maybe they have joint conditions or they have other, you know, physical, you know, limitations that don't allow them to walk. Then find something else. You know, it could be doing a water aerobics class. You know, it could be on an exercise bike. You know, it could be on an elliptical trainer. Of course, those are, you know, that's equipment that requires a facility oftentimes. But those are certainly alternatives, you know, to a walking program.
Right. And you can get them secondhand. They're going to last you the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So it's a one-time investment. Too,
absolutely.
If you need a piece of equipment to do low impact.
Mm-hmm.
And for diabetes, when's the best time of the day to do that walking?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, there's been some really interesting studies recently looking at physical activity, strategic physical activity, particularly in relationship to meals. And so we call that postprandial or after a meal. And there are several studies now that demonstrate that walking after a meal, you know, up to 30 minutes, you know, can significantly decrease blood glucose levels. And so for people who, you know, already have type 2 diabetes, and for those who have prediabetes and, you know, are enrolled in a diabetes prevention program, boy, if they can time that exercise or that physical activity for after mealtime, you know, you'll probably get a little more bang for your buck.
And being active after meals may help us stop eating sooner too. More from today's expert guest after the break and the rest of Robbie's story, so stay with us. Robbie was trying lots of diets to optimize his new diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. He did a vegan, ketogenic, low-carb diet, eating clean with green veggies, nuts, seeds, and oil. But his energy levels were so low, he couldn't sustain it. Here's what happened next. Watch.
I heard a podcast with Dr. Doug Graham. In this podcast, he talked about healing and the concept of natural hygiene, and he talked about eating fruit. And this got me very excited because I had been limiting fruit for a long time now. And I decided I'm going to jump in and I'm going to try this. So I started to eat fruit. This was before his book came out. So he was on the podcast talking about his book that was coming out soon. So I start adding fruit and I start feeling amazing. And I start seeing that I'm getting low blood glucose readings, meaning that the insulin, I'm injecting too much insulin for the food that I'm eating. So you would predict, just like what I predicted, if I'm going to eat more fruit, I'm going to need a lot more insulin. And I did that, but then I kept on going low and had to reduce the insulin and reduce the insulin. So Dr. Graham has sold me on this idea of trying to eat a fruit-based diet, literally nothing but fruits and vegetables. And that's what I have now done for 11 years. So I start doing that, eat nothing but fruits and vegetables. In the beginning, the first week, I signed up for a program with Dr. Graham. It was 1 month of coaching. We ended up doing it for 3 months. I would email him every day, and he emailed me back every day. And we would talk about what I was eating and what was happening with my blood glucose. The first week, I ate nothing but bananas. The second week, I ate nothing but bananas and lettuce. And then I started adding mono meals of fruit after that. And I was mind blown. I couldn't believe how I'm getting to eat all the bananas I want, and my insulin sensitivity continues to improve. I feel amazing, and people would think that if you're eating a bunch of fruit, it would be difficult to control your blood glucose. But that's not the case, because I eat whole fruit, which includes the fiber, the water content, and the nutrients. And that makes it very easy to manage blood glucose. My numbers are predictable. My A1C right now is 5.7%, very healthy range for somebody living with type 1 diabetes. And I'm in complete control of my diabetes health. I have boundless energy. I play sports. I am active with my friends. I go to the gym almost every day. Nothing is holding me back. If someone was in my position, I would suggest they get educated. That's the first step to making lifestyle changes. Once you have the information and you have the confidence of why you're doing this, it becomes a heck of a lot easier. You become much more motivated. You see the results because you know what's happening behind the scenes.
That's why he works, to educate people with diabetes on how to tackle their disease. I once had a patient with type 2 diabetes who would test after meals and then walk until his blood glucose levels came down. He was able to lose weight and stop his insulin completely. Here's Dr. Joy with more on what motivates people with diabetes.
You know, in some respects, the diabetes prevention program, it's as good as an immunization, right? When you look at 71% of 60-year-olds who participated, avoided type 2 diabetes during the study period, well, you know, our flu shot last year was only 40% effective.
And that's a good point.
I'm not saying don't get a flu shot. In fact, everybody should get a flu shot.
But even more people should exercise.
That's right. That's right. Even both. Do both. Walk to the pharmacy and get your flu shots.
There you go. Now, what about apps and wearables? How valuable are those things? Where are we at?
Well, there's some mixed outcomes around wearables, but generally it's pretty positive. They have a bit of a Hawthorne effect, meaning that as you're wearing it for a while, you look at it pretty regularly and you say, "Oh, I'm only at 9,000 steps. If I do just 1,000 steps more, I'll get it." But at about 6 months, it kind of wears off, and then you just kind of wear it on your wrist, and it's not really motivating substantive change. I really think that apps and wearables are in their infancy. We need to have good behavior change theory integrated into the development of apps, for starters. Some of the apps need to have some rigorously defined outcome studies to show that they actually work. And with wearables, we have to figure out how do we prescribe them, right? So that if I'm seeing a patient, I can say, you're not meeting recommended levels of physical activity. I'm going to prescribe this Fitbit to you or some wearable device, and I'm going to have you wear it for 3 months. And in fact, we're going to remote monitor your Fitbit. And so that we can actually see what you're doing. And my nurse, Sadie, she's going to check in with you once a week and say, "Hey, John, I noticed that on Thursday you didn't get any activity at all. What was going on that day? Or, how's that walking program going?" So using wearables strategically, using them from kind of a remote patient monitoring perspective, particularly amongst those who have conditions for which we know physical activity will make the greatest difference in their outcomes. And we're doing some work with that at our healthcare system at Intermountain. And it's been pretty positive so far.
Yeah, because I never thought about that, because that's what happens with blood pressure. Someone mm-hmm. goes home from cardiac rehab, they've got their blood pressure, they need to measure it at mm-hmm. set times. There's no reason why you couldn't do that with exercise.
Absolutely,
too.
Absolutely. We just have to figure out how to do it.
And it's that accountability, and if this is exercise as medicine, right?
Absolutely. And I think that asking people to do anything in perpetuity is pretty unrealistic, right? So, the idea that we're going to kind of slap some, plastic device on somebody's wrist and expect that to make all the difference, for a complex behavior change like exercise, really, it's pretty unrealistic. It ought to be done in the context, with, other supports, whether that's support from a healthcare system or support from a health and fitness professional, from a health coach. I'm really interested in the role of community health workers, and how they can particularly help to support healthy lifestyle behaviors and physical activity among some of our most underserved patients.
And what would their qualifications be as a community health worker?
Well, community health workers tend to be lay people, oftentimes without really any healthcare training, who are sometimes employed by health systems, by third-party payers like insurance companies, to actually work with people in their communities and help them, with adherence to medication, navigation to appointments and to see specialists, connecting with community resources, particularly around social determinants of health, and health behaviors like smoking cessation. That's where the evidence lies. And I think there's some emerging evidence now showing that, community health workers working with families can help them be more physically active. So pretty exciting.
That is. And that's very affordable.
Yes, absolutely.
Mind you, we're looking at a disease like diabetes that is so expensive that almost anything else is affordable, right?
And so incredibly prevalent, right? And its foundation, again, is lifestyle behavior. So we can get a lot of positive from, relatively inexpensive interventions. It's just, figuring out how do we best apply it in a way that adds value to that person's life and isn't seen as intrusive, not big brother. I chip my dog, but I don't chip my kids, and we don't chip our patients. We don't know exactly what they're doing, nor should we, but how do we help them,
Right, and just urge them and encourage them along that journey,
right,
of health.
Yes, Absolutely. It's the Malcolm Gladwell nudge theory, I guess. I think he wrote that book. But, you know, how do we provide those nudges, you know, at the right time, you know, at the right place, by the right person, for the right reason, to the right person, you know, so that they'll be like, oh, yeah, right. This is not my habit yet. But, you know, with the right encouragement, I am going to engage in this behavior change. And then I'm going to start to notice, hey, I feel better. You know, I'm taking less medication. You know, I am sleeping better. I have more energy. You know, I'm doing my job better. I'm feeling like a better parent. You know, I have energy on the weekends to do things with my kids. I'm going to be around for my grandkids. I mean, ultimately, that's what it comes down to, right? I mean, people want to feel better. They want to have a better quality of life. And I think exercise certainly can help them achieve that.
So if you want to feel better and improve your quality of life, think exercise. If you want to live long and live strong, think exercise. It needn't cost more than a good pair of walking shoes. If you have prediabetes, delay the onset of diabetes as long as possible by incorporating physical activity into every day. With diabetes, it makes you more insulin sensitive, as will a nutritious, simple diet, just as Robbie is doing. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.